Jeremy runs amok. A dreadful discovery before dinner. Among the various manners of recovering from the neurasthenic tension that accompanies a drop, I must admit that the one old Abdul had laid on for us took first prize for decadent, that means good, taste.
It's hard to remain stressed out while reclining on a bed of silks in a pleasure palace on Mars, with nubile young squishies to drop pre-fermented grapes into your open mouth, your very own mouth boy to keep the hookah smouldering, and a clanky band plangently plucking its various organs in the far corner of the room.
Dancers swirled and wiggled and undulated across the stage at the front of the hall, while a rather fetching young squishy lad in a gold lamé loincloth and peacock feather turban waited at my left shoulder to keep my cocktail glass from underflowing. Candied fruits and jellied Europan cryoplankton of a most delightful consistency were, of course, provided. "What hell? This is the life, isn't it?" I observed in the general direction of Toadsworth. My bot buddy was parked adjacent to my bower, his knobbly mobility unit sucking luxuriously conditioned juice from a discreet outlet, while the still squishy bits of his internal anatomy slurped a remarkably subtle smoked Korean soy ale from a Klein Stein by way of a curly straw.
"Beep, beep," he responded.
Then, expansively and slowly,
"You seem a little melancholy about something, old chap. In fact, if you had hyperspectral imagers like me, you might notice you were a little drawn, like this, Pip."
He said it so emphatically that even my buggy but priceless family heirloom amanuensis recognized it for an infoburst and misfiled it somewhere.
"Indiscretions aside, if there's anything a cove can do to help you, enemies you want inebriating, planets you want conquering, feel free to ask the toadster what."
"You're a jolly fine fellow, and I may just do that," I said. "But I'm afraid it's probably nothing you can help me with. I'm a bit in a blue funk. Did you know Laura left me? She's done it before several times, of course, but she always comes back after the drop. Not this time, though. I haven't seen gear nor sprocket of her since the day before yesterday, and I'm getting a bit worried."
"I shall make inquiries right away, old chap. The clanky grapevine knows everything. If I may make so bold, she probably just felt the need to get away for a while and lube her flaps. She'll be back soon enough."
Toadsworth swiveled his ocular turret, monospectral emitters flashing brightly.
"Bottoms up!"
I made no comment on the evident fact that if the toadster ever did get himself arse over gripper, he'd be in big trouble righting himself, but merely raised my glass in salute. Then I frowned. It was empty. "Boy, where's my drink?" I glanced round. A furry brown sausage with two prominently flared nostrils was questing about the edge of the bower where my cocktail boy had been sitting a moment before. "Grab that pachyderm!" I shouted at the lad. But I fear it wasn't his fault. Jeremy had already done him a mischief, and he was doubled over in a ball under the nearest curtain, meeping pathetically. Jeremy sucked the remains of my Saturnian ring ice-water margaritas up his nose with a ghastly slurping noise and winked at me. Then he sneezed explosively. An acrid eruption slapped my face. "Vile creature!" I raged. "What do you think you're doing?" I'm told that I am usually quite good with small children and other animals, but I have a blind spot when it comes to Jeremy. He narrowed his eyes, splayed his ears wide, and emitted a triumphant, not to say alcohol-saturated, trumpet blast at me. "Got you," he seemed to be saying. "Why should you two legs have all the fun?" I made a grab for his front legs, but he was too fast for me, nipping right under my seat and out the other side, spiking my unmentionables on the way as I flailed around in search of something to throw at him. "Right! That does it!" People to either side were turning to stare at me, wondering what was going on. "I'm going to get you!" I managed to lever myself upright just in time to see Jeremy scramble out through one of the pointy-looking archways at the back of the hall, then found myself eyeball to hairy eyeball with Ibn Cutthroat's administrative assistant.
"Please not to make so much of a noise, Ralphie-san,"
said the junior under vizier.
"His Excellency has an announcement to make."
And it was true. Human flunkies were discreetly passing among the audience, attracting the guests' attention and quieting down the background of chit-chat. The band had settled down and was gently serenading us with its plucked vocal cords.
I glanced after Jeremy one last time.
"I'll deal with you later," I muttered. Even by Jeremy's usual standards, this behaviour was quite intolerable. If I didn't know better, I'd swear there was something up with the blighter. Then I looked back at the stage at the front of the room. The curtain sublimed in a showy flash of velvet smoke, revealing a high throne cradled in a bower of hydroponically rooted date palms. His Excellency, Abdul al-Matsumoto, younger sibling of the Emir of Mars, rose from his seat upon the throne. Naked eunuch bodyguards, their skins oiled and gleaming, raised their katanas in salute to either side.
"My friends," old Abdul droned in a remarkably un-Abdul-like monotone, "it makes me more happy than I can tell you to welcome you all to my humble retreat tonight."
Abdul wore robes of blinding white cotton and a broad gold chain, first prize for atmosphere diving from the club, I do believe. Behind him, a row of veiled figures in shapeless black robes nudged each other. His wives, I wondered, or his husbands?
"Tonight is the first of my thousand nights and one night," he continued, looking more than slightly glassy-eyed. "In honour of my sort of ancestor, the Sultan Shahryar, and in view of my now being, quote, too old to play the field, my elder brother, peace be unto him, has decreed a competition for my hand in marriage. For this night and the next 1,000, lucky concubines of every appropriate gender combination will vie for the opportunity to become my sole and most important sultana."
"That's right. It's not a date,"
added Ibn Cutthroat from the sidelines.
"I shall take the winner's hand in marriage, along with the rest of their body. The losers, well, that's too boring and tiresome to go into here, but they won't be writing any kiss-and-tell stories. If they forgot to make backups before entering the competition, that's not my problem. Meanwhile, I ask you to raise a toast with me to the first 7 aspiring princesses of Mars standing here behind me, and their intelligence and courage in taking up Scheherazade's wager."
He sounded bored out of his skull, as if his mind was very definitely busy elsewhere. Everyone raised a toast to the competitors, but I was losing my appetite even before Ibn Cutthroat stepped to the front of the stage to explain the terms of the competition, which would begin after the banquet. I may come from a long line of Japanese pretenders to the throne of a sheep-stealing bandit laird, but we'd never consider anything remotely as bloodthirsty and medieval as this. The prospect of spending a night with dashing young Abdul gave a whole new and unwelcome meaning to losing your head for love, as I suppose befitted a pretender to the crown of Ibn Saud, never mind the Sassanid Empire, by way of Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. "I don't think this is very funny," I mumbled to Toadsworth. "I wish Laura was here." Toadsworth nubbed me with his inebriator.
"I don't think you need to worry about that, old chap. I spy with my little hyperspectral telescopic todger."
Ibn Cutthroat was coming to the climax of his spiel.
"Gaze upon the faces of the brave beauties," he crowed. "Ladies, drop your veils."
I gaped like a fool as the row of black-garbed femmes behind the prince threw back their veils and bared their faces to the audience. For there, in the middle of the row, was a familiar set of silver eyelashes.
Isn't that your mistress, old boy?
Toadsworth nudged me with his inebriator attachment.
Jolly rum do, her showing up here, what?
But she can't be, I protested. Laura can't be that stupid, and I always forget to remind her to take her backups, and left to her own devices she never remembers, so...
I'm afraid it's still her on the stage, old boy, commiserated the toadster. There's no getting around it. Do you suppose she answered an advertisement or went through a talent agency?
She must have been on the rebound. This is all my fault, I lamented.
I disagree, old fellow. She's not squishy enough to bounce, not without pulverizing her head first, anyway.
I glanced up at the stage, despondent. The worst part of it was, this was all my fault. If I'd actually bothered to pull myself out of my pre-drop funk and talk to her, she wouldn't be standing on stage, glancing nervously at the court executioners on either side. Then I saw her turn her head. She was looking at me. She mouthed something, and it didn't take a genius of lip-reading to realize that she was saying, "Get me out of here." "I'll rescue you, Laura," I promised, collapsing in a heap of cushions. Then my mouth boy stuck a hooker in the old cake hurl, and the situation lost its urgent edge. Laura wasn't number one on the old chop-chop list after all. There'd be time to help her out of this fix after dinner. An after-dinner show. Discussions of horticulture. Dinner took approximately 4 hours to serve and consisted of tiresomely symbolic courses prepared by master chefs from the various dominions of the Al-Matsumoto Empire, all 60 of them. The resulting cultural melange was certainly unique, and the traditional veal tongue sashimi on a bed of pickled jellyfish couscous à l'Olympia lent a certain urgency to my intercourse swaggers to the vomitorium. But I digress. I barely tasted a single bite, so deeply concerned was I for the whereabouts of my cyberdoxy. After the last platter of chili roast bandersnatch in honey sauce was cleared and the dessert wine piped to our tables, the game show began.
And what a game show! I sat there shuddering through each round, hoping against hope that Laura wouldn't be called this time. Ibn Cutthroat was master of ceremonies, with two dusky-skinned eunuchs to keep track of the scorecards. Contestant number one, Bimzi bin Jalebi. Your next question is, what is His Excellency the Prince's principal hobby?
Bimzi rested one elaborately beringed fingertip on her lower lip and frowned fetchingly at the audience.
Surfing?
Aha! Ha ha! Crowed Ibn Cutthroat. Not quite wrong, but I think you'd all agree she had a close shave there.
The audience howled, not necessarily with joy.
So we'll try again. Bimzi bin Jalebi, what do you think His Excellency the Prince will see in you?
Bimzi rested one elegant hand on a smoothly curved hip and jiggled seductively at the audience.
My unmatched belly dancing skills and,
wink,
pelvic floor musculature.
I am asking the questions around here, mugged the vizier, leering at the audience.
Everyone oohed.
Did you hear a question?
Everybody oohed even louder.
Pip, pip, said Toadsworth quietly. He continued, I detect speech stress analyzers concealed in the pillars, old boy. And something else? Let me remind you, oozed the vizier, that you are attending the court of His Excellency the Prince, and that any untruth told before me, in my capacity as Grand High Judicar before this court, may be revealed and treated as perjury. And...
He paused while a ripple of conversation spread around the room.
Now we come to the third and final cut-off question before you spend a night of delight and jeopardy with His Royal Highness. What do you, Bimzi bin Jalebi, see in my prince? Truthfully now, We have lie detectors and we know how to use them. Bimsy Bin Jalebi smiled coyly and winningly at the audience, then decided that honesty combined with speed was the best policy.
A mountain of gold, but that's not my only...
Enough!
Cutthroat Senior clapped his hands together, and her aborning speech was arrested by the snickersnack of eunuch katanas and a bright squirt of arterial blood.
To cut a long story short, His Excellency can't stand wafflers, or gold diggers for that matter.
He glanced at one particular section of the audience, standing under guard and white with shock, and smiled toothily.
And so, now that we're all running neck and neck, who'd like to be next?
I can't bear this, I groaned quietly.
Don't worry, old fellow. It'll be all right on the night. Toadster nudged me.
To prove him wrong, Ibn Cutthroat hunted through the herd of candidates and, by the same nightmare logic that causes toast to always land buttered side down except when you're watching it with a notepad and counter, who should his gaze fall on but Laura?
You! Yes, you! It could be you! Cried the ghastly little fellow. Step right up, my dear. And what's your name? Laura Bin... Binary?
Ah, such a fragrant blossom, so redolent of machine oil and ceramics. I'd spin her cams any day of the week if I still had my undercarriage. He confided to the crowd, while my pale person of pulchritude clutched a filmy veil around her and flinched.
First question. Are you the front end of an ass?
Laura shook her head. The crowd fell silent. I tensed, balling my hands into fists. If only there was something I could do.
Second question. Are you the back end of an ass?
Laura shook her head again, silently. I tried to catch her eye, but she didn't look my way. I quailed, terrified. Laura is at her most dangerous when she goes quiet.
Well then, let me see. If you're not the front end of an ass, and you're not the back end of an ass, doesn't that mean you're no end of an ass?
Laura gave him the old fisheye for an infinitely long 10 seconds, then drawled, in her best Venusian butter wouldn't melt in her mouth accent,
Why, I do declare, what is this ass you speak of, human, and why are you so eager for a piece of it when you don't have any balls?
I was on my feet, staggering uncertainly toward the stage as Ibn Cutthroat raised his fists above his head.
We have a winner, he declared,
and the crowd went wild.
You, my fragrant rose, have passed the first test and go forward to the second round. My gentles, let it be known that Laura Binary has earned the right to an unforgettable night of ecstasy in the company of His Excellency the Prince.
Sotto voce to the audience.
Unforgettable, because she won't live terribly long afterward, but it's the thought that counts.
I saw red, of course. Dash it, what else is a cove to do but stand up for his lady's honour? But before I could take a step forward, meaty hands descended on each of my shoulders.
Bedtime, rumbled the guard, holding my left arm.
I glanced at his mate, who favoured me with a suggestive leer as he fingered the edge of his blade.
Flower bedtime, he echoed.
Ahem.
I glanced at the stage. Laura struggled vainly, while a cadre of guards, as grotesquely over-augmented as old Edgy, wrapped her in delicate silver manacles.
If you don't mind, old fellow, I've got a jolly good mind to tell your master he can take your daisies and push them up...
Bedtime.
Miss Fang hissed urgently behind my right ear.
We need to talk, she added.
Okay, bedtime,
I agreed, nodding like a fool. Guard number two sighed dispiritedly as he sheathed his sword.
Petunias.
What?
Not daisies. Petunias. Bedtime,
guard number one said brightly.
I think he had a one-track mind.
We were supposed to bury you under the petunias if you resisted,
guard number two explained.
It's so hard on the poor things. They don't get enough sunlight out here, and the soil is too alkaline.
No, no, see, he's quite right. If we bury him, he's supposed to be pushing up daisies,
said guard number one, finally getting hold of the conversation.
So, are you going to bed, or are we going to have to tuck you?
I'm going,
I said. The homicidal horticulturalists let go of me with visible reluctance.
I'm gone,
I whimpered.
Not yet, sir,
said Miss Fang, politely but forcefully propelling me away from the ring of clanky guards surrounding the stage.
Let's continue this conversation in private, shall we?
Miss Fang makes a series of observations. The guards escorted me out of the dining pavilion and up two flights of stairs, then along a passageway to a palatial guest suite which had been made available for the members of the club. Miss Fang followed, outwardly imperturbable, although I heard her swear very quietly when the guards locked and barred the main door.
Dash it all!
I stumbled and sat down on a pile of cushions. I've got to rescue her before it's too late. Miss Fang raised one thin eyebrow.
Indubitably, sir. However, we appear to be locked in a guest suite on the second floor of a heavily fortified palace built by a paranoid emperor with guards standing outside the door to prevent any unscheduled excursions.
Perhaps sir would consider an after-dinner digestif and a post-prandial nap instead.
But I was too far gone in my funk to take heed.
This is my fault. If only I had talked to her instead, she wouldn't be here.
This isn't like Abdul either. I know him. He's a good egg. There must be some mistake.
If sir will listen to me for a minute.
Miss Fang drew a deep and exasperated breath, her chest swelling beneath her traditional black jacket in a most fetching manner.
I believe the key to the problem is not rescuing Miss Laura, but making a successful escape afterward. Sir will perhaps recall the planetary defense grasses and orbital arbalists dug into the walls of the caldera. While I am an adequate pilot, I would much prefer our departure from the second most heavily fortified noble house on Mars to be facilitated by traffic control rather than fire control.
And, she raised one eyebrow infinitesimally,
sir did promise his sister to take care of her mammoth.
Dash it all to hell and back!
I bounced to my feet unsteadily.
Who cares about Jeremy?
Miss Fang fixed me with a steely gaze.
You will, if your sister thinks you've mislaid him on purpose, sir.
Oh.
I nodded, crestfallen, and ambled over to the screen of intricately carved soapstone fretwork that separated the central lounge from the inner servants' corridor. Small thingamabots buzzed and clicked outside, scurrying hither and yon about their menial tasks.
I suppose you're right. Well, then, we need to rescue Laura,
retrieve Jeremy from whatever drunken escapade he's got himself into,
and talk our way out of this. Bally nuisance. Why can't life be simple?
I couldn't possibly comment, sir. Compared to covering for one of Prince W. the 13th's little escapades, this should be a piece of cake. Incidentally, did you notice anything odd about His Excellency the Sheikh Abdul tonight?
What? Apart from his rum desire to butcher my beloved...
I was thinking more along the lines of the spinal parasite crab someone has enterprisingly planted on him since the race, sir.
The spinal? What? Dear me, are you telling me he's caught something nasty? Do I need to take precautions?
Only if sir wishes to avoid having his brain hijacked by a genetically engineered neural parasite, his prefrontal lobes scooped out and eaten, and his body turned into a helpless meat puppet. Mr. Al Matsumoto's burnous covered it incompletely,
and I saw it when he turned round. You might have noticed he's not quite himself right now. I believe it is being controlled by Toshiro Ibn Rashid, the vizier. Oops. I paused a moment in silent sympathy.
Bloody poor show, that.
I've seen more than one attempted coup d'etat in my time, sir, and it occurs to me that this is an unhealthy situation to be in. The banquet continues for 3 more days, and sir might usefully question the wisdom of staying to the end. After all, His Excellency's puppet master didn't throw a party and invite all of the prince's personal friends along for no good reason, did he?
Then I suppose we'll just have to rescue Laura and make our escape.
I stopped.
But how?
I have a plan, sir. If you'd start by taking the sober up, then I'll explain.
A meeting in the tunnels. Miss Feng's plan was certainly everything you could ask for. One might even suspect her of Black Ops training, but experience has taught me that it is best never knowingly to underestimate the lethality of a sufficiently determined butler. I confess I harboured certain misgivings about the nature of her proposed offensive, but with stakes this high, I was prepared to work to any plan, however rare. However, we had to wait until after midnight before we could start. That was when the guards opened the doors to direct a shambolically intoxicated Edge Star and a thoroughly inebriated Toadsworth into our company.
Pip-pop!
Toadsworth burped, drifting into a bumpy halt in the middle of the floor. His cortical turret spun round with the force of the belch, and his lights strobed down through the spectrum and went dark.
I'm being pissed,
said Edge Star, shambling into the pillar and collapsing onto 2 legs.
Hark!
Let me help you with that, I said, stepping forward to relieve him of his camel hair coat and the full firkin of Bragort that Miss Feng had secreted beneath it.
I nearly dropped the cask. 9 gallons of ale is quite an armful, especially when it's bottled up in corrosion-proof steel behind biohazard warning stickers.
Ah, that's better,
mumbled Edgestar, another leg retracting with a hiss of hydraulics and a brief stink of chlorine.
Tired. Good night.
Quietly,
Miss Feng reminded me, as I lowered the deadly cylinder to the tiles.
Excellent. I'll take care of this.
She rolled it on its side, directing it toward the door, as she palmed a preemptive sober-up.
I'm sure it will be quite the hit at the squishy servants' party,
she added, with something very like a shudder. I tiptoed away from the door as she knocked on it, then dived into my room to hide as the bolts rattled. As a servant, Miss Feng stood a better chance of avoiding suspicion than I, but she had other tasks in mind for which Edgestar, Toadsworth, and I were clearly well suited. And so I swallowed my misgivings, picked up the sober-up spray, and approached Toadsworth.
"Excuse me, old chap," I said, "but are you up for a jolly
jape?"
The cortical turret turned toward me, and I confronted a red-rimmed eye stalk.
"Inebriate party."
"Jolly good show, Toadster, but I think you might enjoy this first, what?"
I flicked the sober-up at him.
"Don't want to let the side down, do we?"
There was a muffled explosion. His cortical turret spun round 3 times, and steam hissed from under his gasket.
"You unspeakable bounder," he buzzed at me. "That was below the belt."
His lights flashed ominously.
"I've a good mind to—"
"Well,"
I held up a hand. "I'm terribly sorry, and I'll happily demonstrate the depth of my gratitude by grovelling in any way you can imagine afterward. But we need to rescue Laura from the harem. Then we need to make our escape from the evil vizier and his mind-control crabs."
"Really?"
The toadster froze in place for a moment.
"Did you say evil vizier? With crabs? My favourite kind?"
"Top hat, old boy, top hat."
I waved my hands encouragingly. "All we need to do is get old Edgy awake."
"Somebody mention nominative identifier."
With a whine of overstrained hydraulics, Edgestar Wolf Black began to unfold from his heap on the floor. One foot skidded out from under him and ended up scuttling around the skirting board. It barked furiously until the toadster shot it to death with his inebriator.
Hark! Query vertical axis of orientation.
That way, I said, pointing at the ceiling.
Edgy groaned and began to quiver and fold in on himself, legs and arms retracting and strange panels extending to reveal a neat set of chromed wheels.
Vroom!
He said uncertainly.
Where to?
To the harem. To rescue Laura and the other contestants, while Miss Feng poisons the squishy servants with Uncle Fanshawe's Bragot, I explained. If you'd be so good as to follow me, chaps. I pulled on the black abaya Miss Feng had procured for me, then bent down to tap on the robot servitor's hatch, clutching the identity beacon Miss Feng had acquired from one of the waitrons during dinner. The hatch deigned to recognize the beacon and opened, for which I was duly grateful. The servants' tunnel was built to a more-than-human scale. Not all the bots were small, bleepy things. I screwed my monocle firmly into place and hurried along the dank, roughly finished tunnel, blessing my foresight in remembering to download the map. I don't mind admitting that I was sweating with fright, but at least I was in good company, with Edgestar whizzing alongside like a demented skateboard, and the toadster gliding menacingly through the darkened tunnel, his trusty inebriator raised and ready to squirt. Miss Feng's plan was clear. The unlucky ladies would almost certainly be languishing under lock and key in the harem. Moreover, the harem's main entrance would be guarded by palace eunuchs, or possibly chaperone bots. However, she speculated, the servants' passage would still be open, if we could get past the inevitable guard on the back door. We would find the chaperone bot. I would pretend to be a fainting, misplaced maiden, and Edgy and the toadster would play the part of palace security guards who had found me and were taking me back inside. Getting out would be a little harder, but by then Uncle Fanshawe's tipple should have taken effect. Something moved in the tunnel ahead of me, and I froze, knock-kneed in fear. I don't lack moral fibre. It just gives me the runs. I swore under my breath and stopped dead in my tracks as Toadsworth ran over my hem.
"What is it?"
he buzzed quietly. "I don't know." "Shh." Holding my breath, I listened. There was a faint shuffling noise, a breathy whistling, then a clicking noise from the dark recesses of a twisty little side passage. A shadow moved across the floor and paused. I sniffed, smelling an unholy foulness of stale sweat and something else, something familiar. Then I blinked as two evil red-rimmed orbs brimming with pure, mindless hate loomed out of the darkness toward me. Jeremy! The delinquent dwarf reared back, waving his tusks drunkenly in my face, and I could see his trunk begin to flare, ready to blow a betraying blast on the old blower. There was only one thing for it. I reached out and grabbed. "Hush, you silly old thing! If they hear you, they'll kill you too!" Grabbing a mammoth by the trunk, even a hungover miniature mammoth who's three sheets to the wind and tiddly to the point of winking, is not an adventure I can endorse if you value a quiet life. However, rather than responding with his usual murderous rage at the universe for having made him 16 sizes too small, Jeremy blinked at me tipsily and sat down. For a moment I dared to hope that the incident would pass without upset, but then the gathered toot came out sweet, and the foul little beast sneezed a truly elephantine blast of beer-smelling spray in my direction. I let go instinctively. He struggled back to his feet and began to reverse shambolically into the tunnel, with a mistrustful glare directed over my left shoulder. I tried to scuttle after him, only to be brought up short by the toadster, who was still parked on my skirt. "Dash it all, man! Follow that mammoth!" With a brain-rattling crash, a fiendishly stealthed black chaperone bot jumped over my suddenly stationary form, slipped on the snot-lubed floor, tumbled head over heels into the far wall, and crashed to the ground in a shower of spiked armor and vicious knives. I nearly jumped right out of my skin. Indeed, I believe separating me from my integument had been the sole purpose of its acrobatic display. Before I could gather my disguise and my wits and run, Edgestar revved up to speed and whizzed past me. Rooming like a very vroomy thing, he jumped on the ballybot in a most unfriendly manner. It was a sight to see, I can assure you. The chaperone bots of Al Matsumoto look a lot like Edgestar in humanoid form, only less convivial and disinclined to a discreet afternoon tipple when they could be out and about, briskly ripping unfortunates limb from limb. But being bots, they lack the true elan and esprit of a Clanky, and even a hungover tea trolley of a post-humanoid is a fearsome thing to behold when it gets its cricket box on. Jeremy scampered off into the bowels of the palace, honking tunelessly. Meanwhile, old Edgy bounced up and down on the combat robot's abdomen, squeaking furiously and spinning his wheels. They had cute little cutting discs on their inner rims. The chaperone bot lay on its back, stiletto-tipped legs curling over and inward to stab repeatedly at the assailant on its abdomen, but Edgy was too fast for it. Presently, it stabbed too enthusiastically for its own good, and Edgestar yanked hard, pulling the stinger under the edge of a gaping inspection panel. With a triumphant squeal of brakes, he leapt off the chaperone bot, transforming back into humanoid form in midair as sparks began to fly and an acrid smoke poured from his assailant's joints. "Jolly good show, that transformer!" I exclaimed.
"Pip, pip," said the toadster, regaining some of his joie de vivre.
I consulted my map again.
"The back door to the harem's just around the corner."
I say, old chap, I think you've cleared the last obstacle. Let's shufty, shall we? If we're to be home by tea, it behooves us to get our move on." I find Laura in questionable company. Well, to cut a long story short, there I was in the harem of the Emir of Mar's younger brother, surrounded by adoring femmes, while my two fellows from the club made themselves scarce.
"Darling," Laura trilled, reclining in my arms. "I do confess, I'm so touched."
"I know, my dear, but we can't stay here." I quickly outlined what I knew. "Miss Feng thinks the evil vizier is conspiring to build resentment against the oppressive and harsh autocracy of the Al Matsumoto clan and intends to use it to foment a revolt."
"But the Al Matsumotos aren't harsh and autocratic," complained one of the ladies, a cute blonde bimbette bot, in filmy harem pants and tank top. "They're cute."
The room descended into giggles, but I frowned, for this was no laughing matter. "They'll be harsh and autocratic by the time Ibn Cutthroat's spinal crab is through with Abdul. Dash it all, do you all want to be decapitated? Because that's what's going to happen if the vizier seizes power. He won't have any use for you. He's the chief eunuch. He's an X-man, and his special power is chopping off heads. He probably thinks testosterone is something you catch from sitting too many exams."
"Oh, I'm sure I can fix that,"
a dusky six-armed beauty informed me with a flick of her aristocratic nose.
"I didn't study regenerative medicine for nothing."
Her arch look took in Laura.
"Why don't you just take yourself on your tin-plate tart and leave us to sort out the matter of succession? She was only going to go down hard in the talent round anyway."
"Pip, pip,"
called Toadsworth, sailing from one vaulted side chamber to another in pursuit of a giggling conical debutant, a silk favour knotted around his monocular.
"Party back at my pad, old chap. Bring a nobbly pal. Inseminate. Inseminate. Bzzzt."
I looked away before the sight of his new plug-in could scar my retinas for life. You can't take these clanky stallions anywhere in polite company. They can't so much as wink at a well-lubed socket without wanting to interface with it.
"She's right, darling. We must be going."
Laura laid her elegant head on my shoulder and sighed.
"Oh, I do declare, my feet are killing me."
I scooped her up in my arms, trying to see over a face full of frills.
"I've missed you so much," I told her.
"But what are you doing here anyway?"
"Hush."
She kissed me, and for a moment the world went away.
my brave, butch, bullish Ralphie.
She sighed again. I was going to hold out until after the race, but I just checked into the Hilton when I received a telephone call saying there was a gentleman waiting to see me in the lobby. Jealousy stabbed at me. Who was it? I asked, cringing and glancing away as Edgestar rolled past, having transformed himself into a tentacularly enhanced chaise for the amusement of the blonde Bimbette bot, who appeared to be riding him around the room using his unmentionables as a joystick.
I don't remember, she said dreamily. I woke up here, waiting for my prince. You!
I do declare. But Tashira said he was arranging a surprise, and there'd be a party, and then it all went a little vague. I can tell you, I was freezing inside as I began to realise just how disoriented she was.
Laura, what's gotten into you?
Not you. Not lately, she said sharply, then lapsed back into dreamy incoherence.
But you came to rescue me, Ralphie. Oh, he said you would. I swoon for you. Be my love rocket again.
I saw a small silver receptacle on a nearby table, and my heart sank. She'd clearly been at the happy juice. Then I sneaked a peek at the sockets on the back of her neck, under her hairline, and gasped. Someone had planted a hedonism chip and a mandatory override on her. No wonder she was acting out of sorts. I plucked the ghastly thing out and dropped it on the floor.
Laura, stand up,
I cajoled.
We've got to be leaving. There's a party to be going to, don't you know? Let's go. But my...
She wobbled, then toppled against me. Whoops, she giggled. Pick. I might have pulled the chips out of the fryer, but my fish was still thoroughly pickled. I hadn't expected this, but Miss Feng had insisted I take a reset pill just in case. I hated to use the thing on her. Rather, Laura hated it, and this invariably led to a fight afterward. But sobriety is a lesser evil than being trapped in a castle run by a mad vizier and subjected to mood-altering implants, what? So I pressed the silver cap against the side of her neck and pushed the button. Laura's jaws closed with an audible click, and she tensed in my arms for a second.
Ouch, she said very quietly. You bastard! You know I hate that! What's going on?
You're on Mars, and we're in a bally fix, that's what's going on. This Ibn Cutthroat fellow's a thoroughly bad egg. He sneaked a spinal crab onto old Abdul. I think he picked you up because he wants a handle on me, and doubtless that's why the rest of the club's all here. We'd be the first to notice a change in our boy Abdul's behaviour, wouldn't we? The cad's obviously set up the sticky wicket so he can bowl us all out in one inning.
Dear me.
Laura stood up straight and took a step away from me. Well, then we'd better be going, darling. She straightened her attire and looked around, raising one sculpted eyebrow at my dishevelment.
Do you know how to get out of here?
Certainly. I took her hand in mine and led her toward the central gallery. I'm sure there must be a way out around here somewhere.
Over there,
offered Bin Sawbones, pointing. You can't miss it. Head for the two hulking eunuchs and the evil vizier. She pushed me hard in the small of my back. Sorry, but business is business. When you're trying to marry the second richest man on Mars, you can't afford to be too picky, eh? Jeremy pulls it off. The exit was indeed obstructed by Ibn Cutthroat and his merry headsman, with Abdul in tow, glassy-eyed and arms outstretched, muttering something about brains. And Ibn Cutthroat had spotted us. One thing I will credit the blighter with, his sense of spectacle was perfect.
"Ah, Mr. MacDonald!"
he cried, menacingly twirling the anti-chem war vibrissi glued to his upper lip.
"How disappointing to see you here. I must confess, I hoped you'd have sense enough to stay in your room and keep out of trouble. I suppose you now hope I'm going to tell you all my plans, then lock you in an inadequately secured cell so you can escape.
I'm afraid not. I shall simply have you cut off shortly, chop chop. My game's afoot, and none will stop it now, for the ineluctable dialectic of history is on my side.
I don't care what your dastardly scheme is. I've a bone to pick with you, my man, I cried.
The two headsmen took a step forward, and Laura clung to me in fear, whether feigned or otherwise I could not tell.
How dare you kidnap my concubine on the eve of a drop? That's not cricket, or even baseball. And it'll be a cold day in hell before I see you in any of my clubs, even by the tradesman's entrance.
Meanwhile, Laura thrust a shapely arm inside my abaya and was fumbling with something in my dinner jacket pocket, but my attention was fixed on the villain before me.
Clubs.
The word dropped from his lips with stony disinterest.
As if the degenerate recreations of the oligopatriarchal enemy would be of any interest to me.
I shuddered. It's always a bad sign when the hired help starts talking in polysyllables. One of his nostrils flared angrily.
Clubs and sports and jolly capers, that's all you parasites think of as you gobble down our surplus wealth like the monstrous leeches you are.
I'd struck a nerve, as I could see from the throbbing vein in his temple.
Bloated ticks languishing in the lap of luxury and complaining about your parties and fashions while millions slave to fuel your banquets? Bah!
Laura unwrapped her arm from my robe and covered her face, evidently to shield herself from the scoundrel's accusations.
When we strive to better ourselves, you turn your faces away and sneer, and when we bend our necks, you use us as beasts of burden. Well, I've had enough. It's time to return your stolen loot to the toiling non-you masses.
My jaw dropped.
Dash it all, man. You can't be serious. Are you telling me you're a...
Yes, he grated, his eyes aflame with vindictive glee. The crisis of capitalism is finally at hand at long last. It's about 7 centuries and a great downsizing overdue, but it's time to bring about the dictatorship of the non-you and the resurrection of the proletariat. And your friend Abdul al-Matsumoto is going to play a key role in bringing about the final raising of class consciousness by fertilizing the soil of Olympus with the blood of 1,000 maidens, then crown himself Big Brother and institute a reign of terror that will...
Unfortunately, I can't tell you how the Ibn Cutthroat Committee for the Revolution intended to proceed, because we were interrupted by 2 different people. By Laura, who extended her shapely hand and spritzed him down with aftershave, then by Jeremy. Now, it helps to be aware that harems are not exactly noted for their testosterone-drenched atmosphere. I was, of course, the odd squishy out.
Old Edgy was clearly hors de combat, or combat de whores,
if you'll strangle my French. And the toadster was also otherwise engaged, exploring conic sections with the fembot he'd been chasing earlier. But aside from myself and Ibn Cutthroat, and I suppose Abdul, if he was still at home upstairs, what with that crab thingy plastered to his noggin, there weren't any other remotely butch people present. Jeremy had been in smelly, sullen retreat for the past week. Not to put too fine a point on it, he was in must. That state in which a male mammoth or elephant hates and resents other males because the universe acquires a crystal clarity and his function in life is to... Well, Edgestar and Toadsworth got there first, minus the trumpeting and displays of aggression, but I'm sure you understand. There were no other small male mammals present, but Jeremy was well aware of his enemy and his desperate need to assert his alpha male dominance before he could go in search of cows to cover. And, more importantly, there was one particular scent he associated with the enemy from long mutual acquaintance. His enemy smelled like me, but I was shrouded in a blackly occlusive robe, while Ibn Cutthroat had just been doused in my favourite pheromone-enhanced splash. And whatever Jeremy's other faults, he's never been slow to jump to a conclusion. I do not know what passed through the 80% of Jeremy's cranial capacity that serves as target acquisition and fire control, but he made his choice almost instantly and launched himself straight for where Ibn Cutthroat's crown jewels had once resided.
Proboscideans are not usually noted for their glide ratio, but in the weak Martian gravity, Jeremy was positively aerobatic, and he aimed straight for Tashira's tushy with grace and elegance and tusks.
"Tally-ho, old boy!" I shouted, giving him the old-school best, as Laura took two steps smartly forward and, raising her skirts, daintily kickboxed headsman number one in the forehead with one of her most pointed acids, for her 10-centimetre stiletto heels are not only jolly fine pins, they're physical extensions of her chrome-plated ankles. Now, I confess that things looked dicey when headsman number two turned on me with his axe and bared his teeth at me. But I'm not the Suzuki of MacDonald for nothing, and I know a thing or two about fighting. I threw the abaya back over my head to free my arms and pointed Toadsworth's inebriator, which he had earlier entrusted to my safekeeping in order to free up a socket for his inseminator, at the villain. "Drop it, or I'll drop you," I snarled. My threat didn't work. The thug advanced on me, and as he raised his blade, I discovered, to my horror, that the toadster must have some very strange fingers in order to work that trigger. But just as the barber of Baghdad was about to trim my throat, a svelte black silhouette drew up behind him and poured a canister of vile brown ichor over his head. Screaming and burbling imprecations, he sank to the floor, clawing at his eyes, just in time for Laura to finish him off with a flamenco stomp. Miss Feng cleared her throat apologetically as she lowered the empty firkin to the floor. The brightly painted tiles began to blur and run, where its bregort damp rim rested on them.
Sir might be pleased to note that one has taken the liberty of moving his yacht round to the tradesman's entrance and disabling the Continental Defence Array in anticipation of Sir's departure. Was Sir planning to stay for the bomb surprise, or would he agree that this is one party that he would prefer to cut short?
I glanced at Ibn Cutthroat, who was still writhing in agony under Jeremy's merciless onslaught, and then at the two pithet headsmen. "I think it's a damned shame to outstay our welcome at any party. Don't you agree?" Laura nodded enthusiastically and knelt to tickle Jeremy's trunk. "By all means, let's leave. If you'd be so good as to pour a bucket of cold water over Edgy and the Toadster, I'll take Abdul in hand, and we can drop him off at a discreet clinic where they treat spinal crabs. What?"
"That's a capital idea, sir. I shall see to it at once."
Miss Feng set off to separate the miscreants from their amorous attachments. I turned to Laura, who was still tickling Jeremy, who by now was lying on his back, panting, and raised an eyebrow.
"Isn't he sweet?" she sang.
"If you say so. You're carrying him, though," I said ungratefully. "Let's hie thee well and back to Castle Pooky. This has been altogether too much of the wrong kind of company for me. And I could do with a nightcap in civilized company."
"Darling,"
she grabbed me enthusiastically by the trousers, "and we can watch a replay of your jump together." And indeed, to cut a long story short, that's exactly what we did. But first, I took the precaution of locking Jeremy in the second best guest suite's dungeon with a bottle of port, and gave Miss Feng the night off. After all, two's company, but three's jolly confusing, what?
This ends Trunk and Disorderly, narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Humour is hard. Sometimes it works, but more often it doesn't. It's surprisingly difficult to make other people laugh, as any number of aspiring stand-ups have discovered. Ironically, good humour reads easily, so that we tend to be fooled into thinking that it was a trivial matter to write. One of the finest practitioners working in the English language was P.G. Wodehouse, whose interwar social comedies about the hapless young Bertie Wooster and his long-suffering butler Jeeves have become classics of the field. They're as light as souffles and as easy to absorb as air, which is why it took me 3 years of on and off blood, sweat and tears to squeeze out Trunk and Disorderly, which at its best aspires to the level of Woodhouse's recycling bin. In truth, drama is easy. True comedy is murderously difficult to carry off. I was hoping to get a series of stories out of this universe, but in the end I decided to cut my losses and chalked it up as a test run for Saturn's Children.